From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today on the show, we hear from Milwaukee's newly elected city attorney, Terman Spencer, who was diagnosed with COVID-19 during his campaign. Then, a special edition of Bubbler Talk answers your questions about COVID-19.
If you don't take these measures and you overwhelm the system, then we're in a predicament like Italy, where you're rationing the number of ventilators, you're rationing the number of people who can get into the hospital. Ultimately, this is in the best interest of everybody.
Plus, we'll hear lessons from the last great American pandemic, the Spanish flu of 1918.
This is the apocalypse. This is something that has affected humanity for millennia. It will continue to affect us, and it's something we've lived through before, and we will live through it this time.
Lake Effect is next, but first the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. The Wisconsin spring election was historic. Voters turned out to the polls during a global pandemic, but they also made history in the candidates they chose. One of the biggest upsets of the spring election was the race for Milwaukee City Attorney. Terman Spencer beat out longtime incumbent Grant Langley. Langley held the position for nearly four decades. Spencer ran on the platform of change and made history being elected as Milwaukee's first Black city attorney. WUWM's Angelina Moshe Salazar, in a three-part series, spoke with three candidates who made history in this past election. She first spoke with Milwaukee's first Black county executive, David Crowley, then Milwaukee's first Latina and openly bisexual alderwoman, Jocasta Zamarripa, and today she speaks with Milwaukee's new city attorney, Terman Spencer.
The city attorney's race in Milwaukee doesn't get much attention, but this race certainly was a unique race. You turned a lot of heads early on as you came out strong in the primary, and then you were bedridden with COVID-19 for much of the final weeks of the campaign. But you carried your momentum forward to the general election, where you beat out the incumbent Grant Langley, who has been in office for 36 years. So City Attorney Terman Spencer, with that unique race, with it happening during a global pandemic, with you yourself falling ill, I want to ask, how are you feeling?
What a loaded question. What was I feeling when? Before, after, or?
How were you feeling during the race?
Well, early on, I felt great. I can't say that, because I started getting sick in January. That took me down for about 3 weeks. I like to think this was my third bout with COVID. Then I got about a week reprieve, and then it happened again. Same symptoms, same onset, and another 3 weeks. But we fought through it. We kept moving. And then for the third time when it happened, that one was devastating and knocked me down. But I think because we started the campaign so early, that allow us to maintain a certain degree of momentum and continue on with that. But even during the period when I was sick, I never stopped campaigning.
This was strange for many candidates who had to figure out how to campaign during a public health crisis. Traditional campaigning is you go door to door, you do face to face. It was even more, I would imagine, stressful and challenging for you because you got sick.
During the pandemic, I, like many others, we knew we had to shift the campaign, and it was about time anyway, to more of a media campaign, social media and the like. So that allow us not to be out as much, but be more present in social media.
So how are you feeling now, today?
I'm a lot better than I was. I'm not 100%, but I'm pretty close. I'm trying to arrange clearance. As a matter of fact, I just got notification 5 minutes prior to this that the second test to clear me, to tell me whether or not I'm negative, I'll be able to take, right away, today. So after I do that, get the results, I hope to be out running again with the same vigor that we had during the campaign.
I wish you a speedy and full recovery.
Thank you.
you made history by becoming Milwaukee's first Black city attorney. So please tell our listeners why you believe that this is a significant moment in this city's history.
Well, I think history was made because of the voices of the people, and not really being satisfied with the last three, close to four decades of administration. So having said that, I think it's really important to know that the city attorney's office was in desperate need of reshaping, amelioration, and changing the trajectory of what's been occurring. As such, I think it was the opportune time for me to come in and to run for that on the premise of change. Looking at what some of the things that we are facing and the exorbitant amount of payouts we're paying for the city for police misconduct and the like, it was time. It was time for change. And I think the citizens of Milwaukee felt the same. I mean, well, it's obvious that they did. Mm-hmm. As I ran, it was not just for me running, it was not an I thing. I like to think of it as a we thing. And because the outcome and the numbers, I think that tells us that it's a mandate. It's a mandate that I go in and make those requisite changes that I ran on, because this is what they believe in and what they bought into. So we have to do it.
One thing that you mentioned and you criticized your opponent for was the exorbitant amount of payouts that taxpayers have to pay. Are you referring to our relationship with the police and our community?
Well, it's not just that you mentioned with police. Of course, we need and we have to do a lot of work to better the relationship with the police department and the community. We have to kind of bridge those gaps to let them know and understand that they're there to protect and serve. And we have to kind of change the philosophy and get more to a community policing. So we have to initiate more programs that will allow the community to interact with the police on a more personal basis, where they can embrace the change and get behind them as they do their work. Now, with respect to the cost, that's just part. It's a philosophical approach to how the office had decided to handle certain cases, but it's not just there, it's in other cases too. So I'm gonna take this time to investigate closely so I can substantiate not just what I suspect, but I feel I have some evidence and findings, and I want to collect that data before presenting it to the public. But yes, there's absolutely a problem with the way we approach cases and issues and how we resolve them at the end of the line with that payoff. I think it can be done a lot better.
You will play a major role in the city as the new Milwaukee city attorney. You're going to be protecting Milwaukee's investment in big projects, representing Milwaukee public schools and the pension system, looking at building code violations and discrimination complaints, and as you mentioned, lawsuits against the police. What is one area that you are going to tackle on day one?
Well, you know, I think day one, the easiest thing is to start making the office a little more transparent and open to the public. I think when they call now, and not during the pandemic, but when you call on issues, you're not able to talk to someone. You get these recordings. I think we have to be more available. But now with respect to the other issues, they're not going to be resolved in day one. Nothing can be done on day one other than saying hello, and you can't even do an introduction to the whole staff in day one. But what you can do is you can systematically chronologize what need to be done and start developing a program to attack those things and correct them. But day one, you know, if you make it in the office and start looking at what need to be changed in the decoration, that's monumental in my opinion.
So let's talk about going back to the office. You are recuperating with your health. I'm curious, what does transitioning into this office look like for you?
I think realistically, in light of the pandemic, that transition that would normally be trying to take place 7 days is not going to happen in 7 days. First of all, I have not set foot in the office yet. And I suspect, due to the pandemic, that calendar of transition and being acclimated to the office is going to be somewhere like 30 days out, 35, 40 days. But once I get in, I need to know the players and need to start setting things up. But rest assured, I have not been sitting on my laurels. I have made requisite contacts. I have consultants lined up. So when we do get in the office, we will hit the office and hit the floor running. So I have some objectives. I have a number of folks on my transition committee, former judges, intellectual, legal minds of the community that will be working with me to ensure this transition is made properly. And the best minds will be looking at the city attorney's office because we feel it's a very important office, but there's a lot of change that need to be made. And I won't begin to profess that I'm a know-it-all away with having all the knowledge. So what I've done was I've enlisted the experience of some real reputable people in the legal community and minds to assist me in making this transition.
City Attorney Terman Spencer, I want to give you the opportunity to talk about any final words you want to leave our listeners with.
Well, first of all, I want to say thank you to you, excuse me, for giving me this opportunity. I'd like the listeners to know that I really appreciate you getting behind me to elect me into this office and having faith and trust in me to make these changes. And I will be doing my very best to make sure that I honor everything that I platformed on. I want you to rest assured that I'm going to take the requisite steps to make sure that this is not done arbitrarily or capriciously. I have the best interest of the community at heart, and I'm planning to do the city's work. Because without you, we do not have an office. We do not have a system. So having said that, again, thank you. And I would like to humbly express that I'm honored to be able to be the voice for the city and to lead the direction of the city attorney's office.
Terman Spencer is the newly elected Milwaukee City Attorney. He spoke with WUWM's Angelina Moshe Salazar. Angelina also spoke with Milwaukee County Executive-elect David Crowley and newly elected Milwaukee City Alderman Jocasta Zamarripa. And you can find all three of these interviews at WUWM.com. Coming up next, we go over common coronavirus questions with Dr. Joyce Sanchez from the Medical College of Wisconsin. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. The coronavirus first surfaced at the start of the year, and scientists have learned a lot about the disease since the pandemic began. But there are still a lot of misperceptions and questions surrounding COVID-19. For Bubbler Talk, we've been asking listeners what they want to know about the disease and how it's spread. Dr. Joyce Sanchez is an assistant professor at the Medical College of Wisconsin who specializes in infectious diseases. She joins Lake Effect's Joy Powers to answer listener questions about the coronavirus for this special edition of Bubbler Talk.
I'm sure you're hearing this every day, but there's a lot of confusion around COVID-19 in general. There's so many different ways to look at this issue right now, but I'd like to start here. Do we know how this disease developed?
That's a great question, Joy, and thank you for asking that. It seems like with this particular pandemic, that information sharing and the speed by which discoveries are being made it's just been unprecedented. What we know or have evidence of is that things certainly started in Wuhan, China, and we know that they started in connection with a seafood market in Wuhan, China. A lot of the genetic information that's been shared has linked this particular coronavirus to one that is related to bats. So we have pretty good evidence to suggest that that was the reservoir by which this coronavirus started. We also know that based on previous experience with SARS and MERS, that there was an intermediate host, an intermediate animal that subsequently came into close quarters with bats and subsequently transmitted the virus to people. At this point, we have good evidence to believe that there was an intermediate host within that seafood market. Things have not been definitively established, but enough signal is there to believe that. Then we know that in order for a pandemic to really start spreading, three things need to occur. It needs to be completely novel where there's no baseline immunity, which is the case for this. The second is that there need to be sustained human-to-human transmission, which we saw hints of in December and then finally became itself apparent for sure in January when things became more public nationwide and we started looking more closely at the epidemic going on in China. And the third is that there needs to be some kind of mobility of one person to another. And with how global our economy is, how jumping from country to country, continent to continent is now much easier than it's ever been in our world history. It was the perfect storm. All of the holes in the slice of Swiss cheese were met where this became a problem.
Yeah. You know, you mentioned the coronavirus is novel, and one of our listeners, Lori, she wants to know if there's more than one strain of coronavirus.
There's seven different coronaviruses that we know of, four that we have lots of experience with and identified in the 1960s that caused approximately 30% of cases of the common cold. The coronaviruses that have become more problematic that cause lower respiratory tract infections, viral pneumonia, and some of the really bad sequelae we're seeing now are SARS from 2002, MERS from 2012, and now SARS-CoV-2, which causes COVID-19, the illness. As far as SARS-CoV-2, what's going on with this pandemic, there's definitely differences in genetic sequences, different strains of this virus from region to region. This is a error-prone type of virus. So what happens is when it replicates, it doesn't necessarily replicate exactly the same every time. And so there are some subtle genetic differences. However, those genetic differences have not proven to translate to differences in how the virus actually behaves, such as how transmissible it is or the severity of disease that it may cause, particularly in those who are susceptible. So small changes, but in real life, how that translates, there's really no difference that we're seeing.
Okay. And that gets to another question we got. Connie Walker from West Allis. She wants to know if you can get the virus twice.
I think a lot of us are very interested in that question. And the quick answer is that we don't entirely know right now, but we have some data that gives us some hope that there may be at least some short-term immunity after someone has contracted and recovered from this virus. Certainly our experience with the other four seasonal coronaviruses, we see some short-term immunity, but that doesn't really translate into long-term immunity over years.
Okay. So Milwaukeean Matthew Starr, he's wondering about testing, and I've heard a lot of questions about testing just in general. You know, he wants to know if or when coronavirus testing will be available to everyone, you know, regardless of the severity of these symptoms.
That's an ask and a wish that all of us have. Every single medical professional we'd love to be able to test every single person. A couple of things happened by which made that impossible at the beginning and continues for it to be a challenge. I think first is that we're really limited by the supply chain. So the way things work is that these testing kits come with swabs. It comes with a tube and viral media or liquid for those swabs to be kept in during transport. And then subsequently, they arrive in our lab and they can do this PCR test where they amplify the genetic makeup of the virus to see if it's detectable. Every little component of these kits is assembled via supply chain, and if there is a breakdown of one component of that kit, then the whole kit is non-functional. You need every piece of it. So that's the test we've been using for clinical purposes is this PCR test, and lots of limitations with supply chain. There is a serology that there's been a lot of interest in. However, in the acute phase of the illness, when someone is ill over the first few days, it is not a great test because it takes several days for you to develop an antibody and for that serology to become positive. If I had to guess at what point we'd have commercial testing for everybody, I would say it's probably not going to be prime time for a very long time. The private sector has been ramping up. Our laboratory associated with the Medical College of Wisconsin is, they've actually have more tests than anywhere else in the state, which is great, but it's still not enough to provide testing for everybody who needs it. So we're still prioritizing people who are the most medically vulnerable, starting with those who are in intensive care units or hospitalized in their hospitals throughout the state. We're testing our healthcare workforce because knowing who of our workforce who develops symptoms has COVID-19 has substantial implications on whether or not they go back to work. And we really need to deploy our healthcare workers in response to the volume that's been coming in. And then those who are at highest risk of developing severe disease in the community who may not be sick enough to be in the hospital.
Yeah. You know, we're seeing in other countries, specifically South Korea, but even around the United States, we're seeing these kind of drive-through testing sites. And people are confused about where these testing sites might be, how they could access them. And they want to know, where are these testing sites in Milwaukee? Do we have them?
We do. Every healthcare system has some means of testing. Even if it's not through their own enterprise, they work with someone who does.
So to take kind of a left turn, we have a lot of people who are writing in curious about the limitations and the expectations of social distancing. We got a question from Stephen Baldwin, who says, you know, he's heard that the sooner we start staying at home, the quicker we'll get through to the other side. But, you know, he wants to know if that's true or if it really just makes the caseload of patients more manageable, but ultimately extends the length of the pandemic.
I'm going to call the social distancing physical distancing because that's what it is. You can still be social virtually or from afar. The goal of this is to bring the number of cases down, to flatten the curve, not to overwhelm our healthcare systems, but it's also in the best interest of protecting you, protecting your loved ones, particularly those who are vulnerable, who are at higher risk of developing severe disease and dying. Yes, it'll spread it out. It might lengthen it. The problem is if you don't take these measures and you overwhelm the system, then we're in a predicament like Italy where you're rationing the number of ventilators, you're rationing the number of people who can get into the hospital. Ultimately, this is in the best interest of everybody.
Another physical distancing question. One person wanted to know about kids with divorced parents who share custody. Is it all right for them to spend the weekend with one parent, then move to another home? But, you know, it's not just children of divorced parents. There are a lot of situations in which you might have to travel from home to home. Let's say you care for someone in another home, but you live somewhere else. Is it safe to do that? And what precautions should you be taking if that's something you need to do?
Well, I think if you're up against a wall and you have, in terms of childcare, for example, with the scenario that you proposed here, you have to do what works. And if you don't have an option for kids to stay in one home or for you to stay at home, you know, I'm a healthcare worker. I have no choice but to come into the hospital. We have three healthcare workers in our family, and that's the reality that we're living with. So none of this is a mandate. We're not separating families like what was done in China. That's not something that is going to be of interest. And honestly, I don't know how feasible that would be here. What I would recommend for those who are going from house to house, if it's necessary, like this case is to try to minimize contact to other communities, every other community. So for the husband and wife or ex-husband and wife, if they can stay home, great. If they can telework, great. I know not everyone has the luxury of doing that. Not everyone has the luxury of paid time off either, so that is a problem. But keeping those kids within those two confined homes and absolutely minimizing anyone else who is entering the home unless it's absolutely necessary. So, for example, if you have an elderly family member who gets home care from a nurse or a nanny who has to come in because you're a healthcare worker or an essential worker who has to go out out for your work because it's essential, then, you know, that's what we have to do. And taking the proper precautions, so the hand washing is, that will never change. Coughing into your elbow will not change. Keeping surfaces that are high touch, countertops, laptops, phones, as clean as possible and disinfecting them often, that also does not change.
As you mentioned, of course, we're all trying to stay in our homes as much as possible. But of course, anybody with a dog is going to tell you that's not completely possible all the time. So there are a lot of people who are out walking pets, and they're still coming in contact with other animals they don't live with. We have a listener, Tom Wexler, who wants to know, is there an issue petting other dogs? Let's say the owner is a carrier of the disease, they sneeze on the dog, they just pet their dog perhaps, and then somebody else like Tom goes to pet this same dog. Can the disease spread that way?
Yes, it could. I think that's a fair question. Is that a likely driver of this pandemic? I think not. However, we've been surprised, and we're surprised on a weekly basis of what we're learning. So absolutely, the months are getting warmer, the days are getting warmer. By all means, go outside. I'm not saying not to do that. And I think the shelter in place, I'd argue, is not mandating that either. But to keep that distance when you are outside from people, and that includes pets too. The good news here is that, to my awareness, we've not seen any data where dogs can actually contract illness, but they can serve as something in the medical community that we call a fomite. A fomite is any surface by which virus can be shed onto, and then if someone touches that surface and then touches their face without hand washing, can contract the illness. So I'd categorize dogs as fomites in this setting. And so minimizing dog-to-dog contact or petting another dog that is not in your home as much as possible. I know you can't always control dogs. In fact, most of the time you can't control your dog unless you're a much better person than I am. But if for some reason you're in a situation where the dogs are interacting, you can't control them, or a dog jumps on you and you don't always have control over that, making sure that you wash your hands or use an alcohol-based disinfectant before you touch your face again. It really takes touching a contaminated surface like the fur of a dog and then touching your face for it to be transmitted.
We've seen, of course, a number of countries going through this. I believe the order, the stay-at-home order in Wuhan was finally lifted, so they don't have movement restrictions there anymore. Have we learned anything from other countries, and do we know, looking at what's happened there, what the forecast looks like for us?
That's a great question. I think the current projections are that we're probably going to reach our peak or inflection point, at least in the Milwaukee and Southeast Wisconsin area, in the next couple of weeks, so mid to end of April, potentially first week of May, although time will tell. What I feel has been very important in terms of lessons we've learned is in South Korea, how they were able to more quickly flatten their curve primarily through massive testing and contact tracing efforts. So I think now that we've learned about the supply chain issue and how to better prepare for that in the future, I think a lot more resources, a lot more money is going to be allocated to ensuring that we have the equipment needed in order to respond in the future. And then contact trace so that we are being proactive as opposed to reacting and then being behind the eight ball. One other thing that we've learned is that in Wuhan, yeah, they've definitely started lifting some restrictions, but at the same time, I do have some concern that while there's still some low-level virus in communities, we may see an uptick in cases again. So I think being very diligent about slowly lifting restrictions in step-by-step, day-by-day basis, reevaluating, so that way you're not left in the same situation as we were a couple of months ago. So how that pans out over time is yet to be determined, but I think we need to be mindful about how quickly we lift restrictions.
Yeah, I've seen some murmurs that there are politicians who are hoping to lift things sooner rather than later, which I think has a lot of people concerned.
Absolutely. And, you know, here in Wisconsin, my understanding is that there hasn't yet been a final decision on whether or not schools are completely closed for the duration of this academic year. And, you know, I think there's some benefit in just reevaluating every couple of weeks, which is the incubation period of this virus, and determining rather than just making a blanket statement over the next 2, 3, 4, 5 months. I think that makes sense. But I think it's also important to be realistic and be transparent with the community that we don't know where this is going to go, and preparing for worst case scenario, and to be very cautious and conservative in how quickly you start lifting things and not making promises on any end dates. I know we love to have a date to look forward to that gives us hope, and so I see some value in that. But at the same time, because this virus has behaved in a way that we've never seen before on the globe in this generation, it's really important to have that little asterisk, that little disclaimer, where we could potentially throw a date out there, but understand that that is up to change as we get data in.
So I'd like to end on kind of a more hopeful note. We're getting a lot of questions from people who want to help. So if you're somebody who wants to help healthcare workers, how do you go about doing that?
There are a few really great opportunities that almost everyone can do. Certainly everyone can shelter in place. That's the number one thing that we as a public, no matter what your occupation or vocation is, to contain spread of the disease, you're going to help our healthcare workers by decreasing transmission rates so that we're not seeing a surge or influx otherwise. The second is, if you're someone who has donated blood before, or even if you haven't donated blood, calling in to Versity, the Blood Center of Wisconsin, and donating blood. And with these types of shelter-in-place recommendations, stay home, stay safe, we've seen a drop in the amount of blood donors. And so people who really need it in the hospital who are critically ill, the fear is that we're going to run into a shortage. So if you can donate blood, do. If you don't know, ask, and we can help to make that happen. The second is, if you have either suspect you've contracted the illness or have known to have contracted the illness, COVID-19, and if you've recovered, we are looking for plasma donors who we can actually take the antibodies from and administer to people who are in the hospital who are acutely ill, in the hopes that that can contain some of the viral replication and help speed the viral illness from becoming worse. Another opportunity is, if you happen to have personal protective equipment, so let's say your business has N95 masks or other masks, or even if you're sewing up your own masks, now that we're recommending masks in the community, generally cloth masks for the public, and if you have a sewing machine, or even if you don't, you can start making those. That's easy to do, and dispersing to your community in a safe manner. That's super helpful too.
All right. Well, Dr. Sanchez, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and answering some of these questions.
Thank you for having me.
Support for Bubbler Talk comes from Sunbadger Solar. During this pandemic, WUWM is answering your questions about the coronavirus and its impact on the Milwaukee area. Submit yours at wuwm.com/bubblertalk.
Coming up next, we learn what lessons from the Spanish flu of 1918 could be applied to the coronavirus pandemic. Lake Effect returns in a moment on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Many of us have probably never lived through something like a viral pandemic, but your grandparents might have. Before this coronavirus outbreak, the last time America faced something like what we're living through today was in 1918 during the Spanish flu. As many as one-third of the world contracted the virus, and 50 million people died. Philadelphia was one of the worst-hit cities in America because they didn't follow the kind of social distancing measures recommended both then and now. That's why, even as the CDC predicted something like it could come back to America a couple of years ago, the Philadelphia College of Physicians planned an exhibit to look back at the 1918 Spanish flu. Nancy Hill is the manager of the Mutter Museum, which is run by the College of Physicians of Philadelphia. She spoke with Lake Effect's Julian Haida.
I'm curious about the 1918 flu pandemic, and particularly the ways that local governments or even the national government have approached public health. What changed with regards to public health and how governments handle it and address it?
It's
certainly made that generation aware of public health as an issue, whereas previously, you know, we had had things in Philadelphia like the yellow fever epidemic. The government response to yellow fever was basically that the entire new American government just kind of left the city of Philadelphia for more open areas that was thought to help. That certainly wasn't the response in 1918. I don't think all that much changed in the immediate aftermath. The government response in 1918, I would say, was not great, but that was largely due to the fact that the First World War was still going on, and that was considered a priority. So a lot of public health messaging didn't really make it to the general public because of concerns about patriotism supporting the war effort, as well as issues surrounding stating or letting the opposing forces know that we were compromised. There were censors on a ton of different presses, not just the American press, mostly because both sides of the conflict didn't want the other to know that they were compromised. So in terms of how it's changed since 1918, I think the biggest thing to come out of that pandemic was the flu vaccine that ultimately became available in 1945. Work on that vaccine started in earnest in 1918. They were desperate for a solution to flu pandemics.
Oh, that's very interesting. But there wasn't like a greater understanding of, like, you know, staying indoors and kind of the way that things spread? Or was that already kind of in general knowledge at the time?
Well, some of the things that the government did in 1918, and they certainly did take measures and step out with public health messaging. The name of our exhibit, "That Spreads Death," actually comes from the public health campaign at the time. However, a lot of that stuff wasn't really unveiled or made, you know, communicated to the public until it was already too late, really. I mean, the Liberty Loan Parade was held in Philadelphia on September 28th of 1918, despite public health officials warning that it was a bad idea. And so by the time a lot of this public health messaging came out, which was after that parade, it was already sort of too late. You know, it was already kind of running loose in the populations in different sections of the city. There were also some measures put in place in other cities, not in Philadelphia, but in San Francisco. People were encouraged to wear gauze masks, and at certain points it was illegal to go out in public without wearing a gauze mask. They had a little rhyme about it, which was obey the laws, wear the gauze, protect your jaws from septic paws. So that wasn't just in Philadelphia, but other cities around the country certainly were taking preventative measures, however, given their scientific understanding and the war effort.
Yeah. Now, I think a lot of people who mention or invoke the lessons of the 1918 flu pandemic, the Spanish flu pandemic, and try to apply them to today get a lot of pushback. And they say, well, medicine has changed a lot in the last century. What are some of the lessons that are applicable, and is there enough to learn from 1918 to apply to today? I mean, it seems like messaging is one of the lessons. What else is there, despite the advances in medicine, that we could still learn from 1918?
Yeah, I think it's a little bit ill-informed to dismiss a lot of pandemic concerns, thinking, well, medicine has advanced so much, because it's really less about medical science and more about science in general. In 1918, there wasn't a microscope strong enough to discern the difference between a bacterial organism and a viral organism. So in 1918, they really didn't know what they were fighting, and some of their attempts at inoculation were for a bacterial infection and not for a viral infection. So to some extent, science is definitely on our side. We understand what we're fighting. We understand how these things spread. But I think to kind of rest on the laurels of medicine and say medicine will take care of this for us is not true. A lot of the things that we know still require public participation. You know, you still have to really trust in scientific research. You have to invest in that research. You have to be comfortable and aware of viral surveillance, which is going on around the world. In China, for all of the shortcomings that I'm sure you've been hearing about in the media, China does have a very good viral surveillance program going on over there. And again, the other issue is vaccine compliance. Is you can kind of talk about all of the great things that medicine does and all of the things that medicine can fix, but if people are not willing to comply and get vaccines, we're still going to see viral outbreaks like this. So, you know, I certainly wouldn't encourage anyone to rest on the laurels of modern medicine, because so much of what we've learned since 1918, while valuable and amazing, does require the general public participation. So that's just as important.
Mm. Now, so you mentioned some of the public information campaigns from 1918 as one of the things that, you know, the government did to try to prevent the spread of the Spanish flu. And, we've talked about the efficacy of that and the effectiveness of that. But some of the measures, I'm curious, because right now people are trying to resist some of the public health measures that are being imposed. And they certainly, to some people, feel like an imposition. Were those public health policies, those mandates in 1918, 1919, were they popular? Was there mass resistance to those in a kind of way that we recognize now, or did people trust their governments at the time as well?
I think people certainly trusted the government a little bit more, but largely due to, the war effort that was going on. Being unpatriotic was one of the worst things that you could be perceived as. So if you were kind of speaking against the U.S. government, obviously that would have been perceived as a bad thing for other reasons. I should say that there wasn't really a national effort or any national messaging about the flu. It was very much kind of local, city and state-based messaging. The president at the time actually caught the flu and never actually made a general public address about the pandemic.
Wow.
Very, very different time. Again, the war effort very much shaped a lot of the responses. And it's easy to look back on those things now and say, God, what a mistake. But when you're looking at the first major world war military conflict and the debut of gas warfare, I think it's kind of a fair thing that they maybe considered the Kaiser a bigger threat early on. I will say the public health messaging that was received, I know that there were some arrests in San Francisco once they made it illegal to go out without a mask, but a lot of that messaging didn't come out until people were already seeing their friends and neighbors dying. And so it very quickly was real to people. Locally in Philadelphia, there was a major burial crisis that resulted from this. We've been collecting stories from local families who had a relative or an ancestor who lived at the time. Overwhelmingly, the thing that we hear that stuck in people's memories were bodies piling up in the street. And so I think it was less about if the messaging was popular. I think that people knew that it was necessary because it came basically at the same time and after the virus. So people were already seeing, yes, this is necessary. My next door neighbor is dying. My mother is dying. There was a very strong kind of social code against defying the American government, largely due to the wartime conflict going on too. So I think it was a very, very different time in a lot of ways. But again, I think we have the privilege right now, and many younger people especially, a lot of this doesn't seem real. It doesn't seem possible. This is stuff that happened somewhere else, and we really are privileged to have seen things like the SARS epidemic, and it didn't really make it to North America in a large way, the way that COVID-19 is. And so part of why this messaging is unpopular, I would imagine, is because people don't recognize how necessary it is. But once we start seeing death tolls spiking, and if, God forbid, it got to the point that we were having burial crisis issues, it would be, that messaging would become a lot more agreeable pretty quickly, I would imagine.
Yeah. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Lake Effect on WUWM 89.7, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Julian Haida, and I'm speaking with Nancy Hill. She's the museum manager at the Mutter Museum in Philadelphia that's associated with the College of Physicians there. Now, I wanted to ask you as well a little bit about the mutual aid and social aspects of countering the Spanish flu in 1918. A lot of people are talking now about, using their 3D printers for ventilator parts or sewing together masks. Was there a kind of a social element that I imagine, might have been, adjacent to the war effort, First World War? Was there some sort of social effort to get prevention or medicine, or you mentioned burial of the dead, that was kind of broadly public or popular?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the silver lining on the story of the 1918 pandemic is that, where a lot of local governments and the city government of Philadelphia, the system certainly fell apart pretty quickly and were overwhelmed pretty quickly. Citizens really stepped up to the plate to fill in those gaps and keep things running smoothly. So There was actually one of the kind of more amazing stories in Philadelphia was that there was a group, it was kind of a committee that was put together, and they were, their initial purpose was to observe the war industry factories here and make sure people were being paid fairly and, you know, doing work well and the hiring processes were fair and all of that. They very quickly realized it was a better investment of their time to address the flu pandemic, and they actually took over one of the phone lines at the local Strawbridge's store and set up basically a helpline that anyone could call the Strawbridge's store and say flu, and they would be connected to someone who would try to send resources out to them to assess what was going on and try to address their needs.
What was the store?
At Strawbridge's in Clovier.
What is that?
It's a large it was a department store.
Oh, so it's just like a regular department store. So it wasn't anything special.
Yeah, so it was one of the big fancy department stores in Center City, Philadelphia, and they had a number of telephone lines, and they allowed this citizens group to take over one of the phone lines so that local civilians who needed help could have a number to call and have someone send out resources to their respective neighborhoods.
Wow. So just having having some extra phone lines was an asset that society could use to help in the fight against the pandemic.
Yeah. So you would call Strawbridge's, you would say flu, and they would connect you to the flu line, and you would say, hey, you know, I'm in Kensington, and there's a lot of bodies in the streets, and they would say, okay, we'll send somebody out to check it out and try to get somebody out there for an enforcement card, things like that. We also had citizens who were volunteering their personal cars and driving as ambulances. You would get a green flag to put on your car, and you would help drive people to the hospital. There were people who were cooking for their neighborhoods and cooking for their communities if they were still well, watching their neighbors' children. And then even the seminary students, there were some seminary schools who had their classes canceled. The seminary students were basically partnered up and sent out to either collect the dead, or they were digging graves in the Catholic cemeteries. There was actually a number of temporary mass graves here in Philadelphia. Most people did get a proper burial once the city had kind of returned to normal, but it was the seminary students who were doing a lot of the physical labor to address that.
Wow. So it really, really was a broad popular effort at the time.
Yeah. Again, I think people were seeing that messaging about doing your part to support the war effort and, you know, buying your bonds and growing gardens and all that stuff. So I think people were in the mindset of volunteerism already. And when they, you know, pretty naturally, when they saw that there were shortcomings in their community, the struggling people were ready to step up to the plate. And I think it's great that we're seeing that today. You know, I've been seeing a lot of people throwing masks for their local hospitals. There's a number of things online where people are buying meals from small businesses that perhaps are closed to the general public or that are struggling a little bit. So buying meals for hospital staff, so you're not only feeding the hospital staff, but supporting a local business, things like that. So I will say it has been encouraging to see people trying to do as much as they can remotely. And we have the benefit of the internet now, too, which makes things much easier.
Yeah. Are you at all surprised with how... You know, I don't know if uncanny is the right word, but how things today seem to be really similar, save for the new technology, to how things were during the 1918 flu.
Yeah, I mean, so we chose this topic for an exhibit, knowing that at any point in time, you know, this is going to be up for a number of years. We knew at any point there would be something public health related in the news. We were kind of thinking that it would be Ebola. There's some antibiotic resistant syphilis strains here in Philadelphia, things like that. We were pretty surprised that there ended up being another kind of major viral epidemic. It probably shouldn't have been, just because the CDC and the WHO have been warning us that we're due for one. But I think, you know, we've all been pretty surprised by it, but there's a lot that we can take from the 1918 experience. I mean, there's a lot more that we understand now. There's a lot of effort that was put in 1918, and the people in 1918 would be very jealous of all of the tools and all the knowledge that we have now. And I think we kind of owe it to our, you know, 102-year-old counterparts to do our best to address this and to work collectively to minimize the impact of it. You know, they would have been desperate for things like the internet and viral understanding and RNA testing and things like that.
Yeah. Are there any, I don't want to say predictions, but warnings from 1918? I mean, it's the springtime right now. I understand that the 1918 flu really took off in the fall and bled into the following year. Is there anything like that that you think might help us prepare better in the year 2020, or whether it be fall in 2021?
Well, I think the most obvious thing came with the cancellation of St. Patrick's Day parades in 1918. They went ahead with that Liberty Loan parade, and within 72 hours of the parade, all 32 hospitals in Philadelphia at the time were full. So I think we're already doing well by, you know, a lot of these cities that canceled the St. Patrick's Day parade. I think the other thing that we should kind of keep in mind from that is really social distancing is going to be really important, and also staying calm. I think it's difficult to recognize that this has happened before. It's not in our living memory, but this has happened before, and we have lived through it. It's going to be difficult, and it's going to be upsetting. At the law, you know, any loss of life is upsetting. But at the same time, I know people are joking about this being the apocalypse and our apocalypse outfits being pajamas instead of something a little bit more Mad Max, right? But at the same time, this isn't the apocalypse. This is something that has affected humanity for millennia. It will continue to affect us. And it's something we've lived through before, and we will live through it this time. It's, again, not to kind of minimize the difficult times that many of us are in for. But the sky is not falling. Humanity has survived things like this before. And so do your best to kind of keep calm and, you know, take care of the people around you and do your part to keep this from spreading. But also be aware that, you know, this isn't the apocalypse by any means.
Well, Nancy, thank you so much for joining us and sharing some of these insights from the 1918 Spanish flu pandemic.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me again.
Nancy Hill is the museum manager at the Mutter Museum at the College of Physicians of Philadelphia. Their exhibit, with materials online, is called Spit Spreads Death, the Influenza Pandemic of 1918 to 1919. And that's today's edition of the show. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Julian Haida and Joy Powers join me in producing Lake Effect each week with help from our executive producer, Becky Mortensen. We also heard from Angelina Mosher-Salazar and Susan Bentz from the WUWM News Team this week. Lauren Sigvason is our digital producer, Jason Reavy is our studio engineer, and Michelle Maternowski is our managing editor. Willie Porter wrote our theme music. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and I hope you can join us again Saturday and Sunday at 3 for Lake Effect Weekend. That's right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. It's 11 o'clock, so stay tuned. Fresh air comes your way next.